position number 12139, Reel 1.
General Breeden, Reel 1. May I ask you, first of all, General, how you came to have your nickname Bala?
Well, when I was at Sandhurst, I was one of several cadets who wanted to go to the Royal Ulster Rifles. And at that time, there was a great racing set in my future regiment, as it was then. They were backing a horse called Bala Hissa, which was owned by the Aga Khan. This is in 1936. And they reckoned they were going to make a lot of money out of this horse. I became the favorite of the three or four people from Sandhurst to go to the regiment at the end of that term. And by the time I got there, my name and that of this horse were synonymous. And that is how it started. It was then built on again by the fact that about a year later or so, I was in Palestine commanding my platoon, sitting on a hilltop for about a month, watching an Arab village near Nablus called Bala. And then the third coincidence is that the name of the horse, Bala Hissa, was named after the fort called the Bala Hissa in Peshawar, which is where I was born when my father was serving on the Northwest Frontier. So that was that, and there was nothing more I could do about it.
Now, last time I interviewed you, it was about the Arab revolt period in Palestine in the late 30s, but after that you were involved with the 1940 campaign in France. Can you tell me what position you held and where you were when the Germans launched their attack on May the 10th, 1940?
Yes, we were stationed in in and around a little village called Le Zen, not very far from Lille. And we had spent the whole of that Cold War period before the German attack in digging and fortifying a line in that area. When the Germans attacked, we were quite well organized. Everybody had suspected that something like this was probably going to happen, and we were very lucky in the fact that we were in General Montgomery's division, the 3rd Division, and he had given us numerous exercises to practice how to rush forward and, funnily enough, how to retreat as well. And so when the balloon went up and we heard in the middle of the night that the German advance had started, we moved within the next 12 hours and we went to our final objective, where we were going to hold the Germans, we hoped, in Louvain. And on our way, we had our first taste of modern warfare in the shape of dive bombers. Luckily, we had, I think we had one or two casualties, but not much. And the move up through Belgium was very smooth. We finally got into the city of Louvain, and my platoon was delegated a stretch of railway line to defend, just to the west of Louvain railway station. My neighboring platoon commander was actually in the railway station. He was lucky because you were able to nip around in the railway station under the railway from these various tunnels. my position was astride the road leading towards Germany, and there was a bridge over the road, a railway bridge over the road, and our positions were actually along the actual railway line, using the rails as our sort of head protection. But the thing that has stuck in my mind is that the only way of getting up to this place, because there was a steep wall this side of the railway, was up a ladder with 27 rungs. And we knew all about this ladder later because when we had to carry lots of extra boxes of small arms ammunition, carrying a box of 1,000 rounds up a ladder with 27 rungs, especially when you're being shot at by ones from a flank, was not an easy job. And when and if you got to the top of the ladder, you threw the box, if you could throw it, over the top and rolled into your slit trench, which was just alongside the railway lines. Well, we manned this position, and there was a splendid sapper corporal who had mined the bridge over the road. And our instructions were that if the enemy approached, then we had got to have the bridge blown. Meanwhile, enormous crowds of unfortunate civilians from the east were crowding down the road. Most of them were walking, but a number had cars. And one's recollection particularly is the fact that everybody put a mattress or two on the top of the roof of his car to try and stop the impact of bullets from German aircraft. And one sad accident happened before the enemy ever arrived, and that was that mines which the Belgian army had put down just the other side of the bridge, were run over by a car, which killed all the people inside it and one or two people who were just passing as well. However, that probably accustomed us to the sort of things which were liable to happen in the near future. On the day when the Germans arrived, which was two or three days after we actually arrived in Louvain, I was sitting with my batman about 100 yards on the enemy side, you might say, of this bridge, looking down a long, straight piece of road. And I was sitting in a chair reading a newspaper. And by that time, the crowd of refugees had thinned out and there were hardly any coming along at all. And also, the colonel of the 15th, 19th Hussars in, I can't remember, some sort of vehicle, came past, checked in with me, and said, well, he thought that he was the last of the cavalry who had been out in front to be able to let us know when the enemy were approaching, and that I could expect the enemy to arrive fairly soon. I thanked him very much, and he wished me good luck, and I went on reading my newspaper. And a little while later, my batman said, look, can you see the other end of this long, straight piece of road, which is about half a mile or more long? He said, I think there's somebody coming now. And I looked up and I got my binoculars. And there was a German motorbike and sidecar coming up the road. So I told my batman and another soldier who were there to wait for a moment or two until these people were within reasonable range to open fire and then join me back in front of the bridge. And this they did. And they then joined me in front of the bridge, and then all three of us went back to our platoon position, meanwhile telling the Royal Engineer NCO to blow the bridge. And all this happened very satisfactorily. Well, then you can say for the next, I think it was about 3 days, there was fairly violent fighting, and the Germans did everything they could to break the line in our area. We were, in fact, my regiment, the 2nd Battalion of the Royal Ulster Rifles, we were the left-hand battalion of our brigade, and there was a battalion of the Grenadier Guards on my left. And I knew the platoon commander who had been at Santos with me, so we were able to liaise fairly well. The enemy, you could see, had been very well trained, but they were trained so well that they did things in a way that you could almost know what they were going to do. They must have been to a training school where they did things in a diametrical sort of form. In front of us, and looking across the railway line, there was a fairly large building. I think it was a four-story building, slightly to our right. But to our left, it was completely open, and there was a hillside sloping upwards away from us, which was covered in allotments, looking very much like a British set of allotments. In fact, I often look at from Colchester Station, where I live near Colchester, and I'm going up to London, and on the northern side of Colchester Station, there is an almost exact replica of this area, because at the top of the slope, there was a row of houses, and the enemy sent people to sort of try and find out where we were, and a certain amount of desultory fighting started. And then gradually you could see that they knew what they were going to do, and they made a very big attempt to occupy this house to our right front, which was only about 70 to 100 yards in front of us. I suppose you could say that we hadn't located ourselves in a very good position, but it was the best one that we could think of, I suppose. It would have been prepared for us by the Belgians, and so there was nothing much more that we could do about it. But a thing that did play into our hands rather well was that the Germans proceeded to come and occupy the allotments. And in those days, almost every man in the battalion was, if not a marksman, he was a first-class shot. And we had only quite recently been issued with Bren guns, having given up the old Lewis gun, which was a World War I gun. And our marksmanship really tailed off. And I hope that they are going to be able to go on having Bisley I hear that Bisley is in danger. The enemy at this stage had the usual shaped German helmets, but they were polished, obviously polished, and they showed up very nicely for us to shoot at. And they did the usual business of running in ones and twos with a few, with a gap between each one. But they hadn't reckoned, quite honestly, with our marksmanship. And the other stupid thing they did, I'm talking probably in a slightly cynical way, but they hid behind these allotment shelters, not appearing to realize that bullets can go through little wooden shelters. And so I think we caused a very large number of casualties with the Germans, and this started to bring them to a halt. At the same time, they were getting into this building in front of us, and this was a real danger. And we were getting casualties because they had various... they had a weapon that we couldn't quite make out what it was, but it was a very heavy machine gun. And we were getting casualties.
Why couldn't you make out what it was?
We called it the Gedunker gun because it made a noise like gedunk, gedunk, gedunk. And it was a type of heavy machine gun, so we heard later. They might have been using a form of anti-tank gun as well, but this was a sort of automatic gun, and it made a noise more like one used to hear with the Bofors gun. It was a repeating gun, and that was the worst thing that we thought that they'd got to use against us. But they got into this building, and this was very dangerous because they started putting snipers up in the top of it, which meant that they could look almost down into our positions. And indeed, very sad to say, my batman was killed with a bullet straight through his head, which came from this building. One or two chaps who we had in a particular post just out in front of the railway, they were getting into quite a lot of danger. And one of them got quite badly wounded. And one of my corporals did a marvelous thing, and he said, look, there seems to be a bit of a lull. I'll go and help the other chap to pull this fella in, which they did. So we evacuated that particular position, which had been in front of the railway line. And this chap was brought back and somehow got down the ladder and off a way back to hospital eventually. And he survived. Very sadly, this corporal... didn't survive. He got killed, I think, next day. And he got killed when there was a tremendous rush of the enemy who very nearly succeeded in overrunning us. But this particular corporal manned his... Bren gun, firing magazine after magazine, and I think he really almost single-handedly stopped that particular attempt. Unfortunately, the only thing that he could have got was a Victoria Cross when he was killed, and he was recommended for such, but there were many others, I suppose, who really did the same sort of thing, but he was a... His whole act during this 2 or 3 days was up to every stand that one could have wished for. Well, this went on, and for a space, I think it was for about 6 hours, I was relieved by a great friend of mine called Ty Wood, Digger Ty Wood, he was known as, who was another second lieutenant, and he came and relieved me. And then I think about that was in order to try and get a bit of sleep. We relieved each other in sort of twos and threes to get a little bit of sleep. But I was back by before dawn the next morning, and this was when the enemy had obviously been reinforced, and they were going to make a bigger and better effort. The stage was reached where we could see that they were getting closer and closer, and the building in front was being more occupied. Our gunners had done a certain amount of damage to the top of the building, although it was very close, I think that had discouraged the snipers from being up there. But a stage was reached where, under some trucks which were to our half right on the railway line, it was a big goods yard, so there were a whole set of railway lines. It was broad, like sort of Clapham Junction. And we could actually see the legs of German soldiers running around, obviously preparing for an assault. And at that moment, I thought, well, there's only one thing for it, and that is to get our artillery firing what was known as an uncle target. It was something that Field Marshal Montgomery had more or less invented. And it was a system whereby all the guns of a regiment of artillery, and if necessary, the guns of more regiments of artillery, could all be brought to bear onto one spot for whatever length of time was necessary, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. And so he got the whole of the 72 guns, or let me go back. I, believe it or not, the telephone was still working. I'm not quite sure why or how. And I telephoned back to say, please bring down an uncle target, which meant the guns of the whole of the division, 72 guns, onto a spot approximately 100 yards in front of our position. Now, I realize that probably one or two of their shells would probably fall on us, but we reckoned that it was better to be killed by our own shells than to be overrun by the enemy. And this happened. When I say this happened, the shells came down. Only about two fell behind us, and none of them fell actually on our positions. And the noise was quite staggering for 3 minutes or whatever it was. And most of the building in front disappeared, and there was an incredible silence from the enemy for quite some time after that. And the only noise when this blast of artillery fire had finished, the only noise one seemed to hear was slates slithering off roofs in the neighborhood. But it seemed to put paid to whatever the Germans had been planning for that day. And the next day was relatively quiet, a certain amount of sniping, and there was an attempt by the enemy to try and get behind us in a in what they thought was a gap between my platoon and the right-hand Grenadier Guards platoon. They succeeded up to a point, but I think that the Guards managed to shove them back. But there was a nasty moment when they were actually in a position where they could shoot at us, trying to get up and down our ladder. And that was very nasty.
Why were these targets called Uncle targets? How did they get their name?
It was, I think, invented probably when it was thought up in Lark Hill. I think a monkey target was I can't remember. There were various things. There was a monkey target and an uncle target and a something else target. I know that the uncle target represented the fire of all the guns in a division, and I suspect that the monkey target was all the guns supporting, say, one brigade. Well, as I say, the next day was relatively quiet, and then we received orders to withdraw.
And how did everybody react to that?
Well, we had been kept roughly in touch with what was going on. We realized that the Germans had broken through away to our right. And in fact, we knew that something curious was happening on our right, because we could hear the most tremendous thunder of guns all the time, day and night, away to our right. It was confirmed that they had broken through, and that we would have to withdraw so that we didn't get cut off. And the withdrawal again, it showed how very well and carefully we'd been trained in how to withdraw, quite apart from anything else. And we took off at sometime after dark, doing the usual thing of leaving one or two men, sort of particularly good men, who had individuality and could cope by themselves, to pretend that we were still there by firing the odd shot for another hour or so after we left. And then their job was to sneak out and follow our tracks and join up with us later. And I always remember going marching through the gun lines, which were a mile or two or whatever it was back, and the whole place was sort of lit up as if it was day with the gun flashes, and they were firing again to rather cover our withdrawal, so that the enemy would probably keep quiet at least until the guns had stopped firing, and then of course, the guns themselves would have to thin out and go back, leaving one or two firing, and do exactly the same as we'd been doing. And